A heap of broken images, where the sun beats, and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water, only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow in the morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland. If there pushed any ragged thistle stalk above its mates, the head was chopped. The bents were jealous else. What made those holes and rents in the dock's harsh swarth leaves, bruised as to balk all hope of greenness? 'Tis a brute must walk, pashing their life out with a brute's intents. Robert Browning, Childe Roland to the Dark Tower came. "What river is it?" inquired Millicent idly. "It's only a stream. Well, perhaps a little more than that. It's called the Waste."
"Is it, really?"
"Yes," said Winifred.
"It is."
Robert Aikman, Hand in Glove. Book One, Jake. Fear in a Handful of Dust. 1. Bear and Bone. 1. It was her third time with live ammunition, and her first time on the draw from the holster Roland had rigged for her. They had plenty of live rounds. Roland had brought back better than 300 from the world where Eddie and Susanna Dean had lived their lives up until the time of their drawing. But having ammunition in plenty did not mean it could be wasted. Quite the contrary, in fact. The gods frowned upon wastrel. Roland had been raised, first by his father and then by Court, his greatest teacher, to believe this, and so he still believed. Those gods might not punish at once, but sooner or later the penance would have to be paid, and the longer the wait, the greater the weight. At first there had been no need for live ammunition anyway. Roland had been shooting for more years than the beautiful brown-skinned woman in the wheelchair would believe. He had corrected her at first simply by watching her aim and dry-fire at the targets he had set up. She learned fast. Both she and Eddie learned fast. As he had suspected, both were born gunslingers. Today Roland and Susanna had come to a clearing less than a mile from the camp in the woods, which had been home to them for almost 2 months now. The days had passed with their own sweet similarity. The gunslinger's body healed itself while Eddie and Susanna learned the things the gunslinger had to teach them. How to shoot, to hunt, to gut and clean what they had killed. How to first stretch, then tan and cure the hides of those kills. How to use as much as it was possible to use so that no part of the animal was wasted. How to find north by Old Star or south by Old Mother. How to listen to the forest in which they now found themselves 60 miles or more northeast of the Western Sea. Today Eddie had stayed behind, and the gunslinger was not put out of countenance by this. The lessons which are remembered the longest, Roland knew, are always the ones that are self-taught. But what had always been the most important lesson was still most important. How to shoot, and how to hit what you shot at every time. How to kill. The edges of this clearing had been formed by dark, sweet-smelling fir trees that curved around it in a ragged semicircle. To the south, the ground broke off and dropped 300 feet in a series of crumbling shale ledges and fractured cliffs, like a giant set of stairs. A clear stream ran out of the woods and across the center of the clearing, first bubbling through a deep channel in the spongy earth and friable stone, then pouring across the splintery rock floor, which sloped down to the place where the land dropped away. The water descended the steps in a series of waterfalls and made any number of pretty, wavering rainbows. Beyond the edge of the drop-off was a magnificent deep valley, choked with more firs and a few great old elm trees, which refused to be crowded out. These latter towered, green and lush, trees which might have been old when the land from which Roland had come was yet young. He could see no sign that the valley had ever burned, although he supposed it must have drawn lightning at some time or other. Nor would lightning have been the only danger. There had been people in this forest in some distant time. Roland had come across their leavings on several occasions over the past weeks. They were primitive artifacts for the most part, but they included shards of pottery, which could only have been cast in fire. And fire was evil stuff that delighted in escaping the hands which created it. Above this picture-book scene arched a blameless blue sky, in which a few crows circled some miles off, crying in their old rusty voices. They seemed restless, as if a storm were on the way. But Roland had sniffed the air, and there was no rain in it. A boulder stood to the left of the stream. Roland had set up 6 chips of stone on top of it. Each one was heavily flecked with mica, and they glittered like lenses in the warm afternoon light. "Last chance," the gunslinger said. "If that holster's uncomfortable, even the slightest bit, tell me now. We didn't come here to waste ammunition." She cocked a sardonic eye at him, and for a moment he could see Detta Walker in there. It was like hazy sunlight winking off a bar of steel.
"What would you do if it was uncomfortable and I didn't tell you? If I missed all 6 of those itty-bitty things? Walk me upside the head like that old teacher yours used to do?"
The gunslinger smiled. He had done more smiling these last 5 weeks than he had done in the 5 years which had come before them. "I can't do that, and you know it. We were children, for one thing, children who hadn't been through our rites of manhood yet. You may slap a child to correct him or her, but in my world whopping the kiddies is also frowned on by the better class of people," Susanna said dryly. Roland shrugged. It was hard for him to imagine that sort of world. Did not the great book say, "Spare not the birch, so you spoil not the child"? But he didn't believe Susanna was lying. "Your world has not moved on," he said. "Many things are different there. Did I not see for myself that it is so?"
"I guess you did."
"In any case, you and Eddie are not children. It would be wrong for me to treat you as if you were. And if tests were needed, you both passed them." Although he did not say so, he was thinking of how it had ended on the beach when she had blown 3 of the lumbering lobstrosities to hell before they could peel him and Eddie to the bone. He saw her answering smile and thought she might be remembering the same thing.
"So what you gonna do if I shoot for shit?"
"I'll look at you. I think that's all I'll need to do." She thought this over, then nodded.
"Might be."
She tested the gun belt again. It was slung across her bosom, almost like a shoulder holster, an arrangement Roland thought of as a docker's clutch, and looked simple enough, but it had taken many weeks of trial and error and a great deal of tailoring to get it just right. The belt and the revolver, which cocked its eroded sandalwood grip out of the ancient oiled holster, had once been the gunslinger's. The holster had hung on his right hip. He had spent much of the last 5 weeks coming to realize it was never going to hang there again. Thanks to the lobstrosities, he was strictly a left-handed gun now. "So how is it?" he asked again. This time she laughed up at him.
"Roland, this old gun belt's as comfortable as it's ever gonna be. Now, do you want me to shoot, or are we just gonna sit and listen to crow music from over yonder?"
He felt tension worming sharp little fingers under his skin now, and he supposed Court had felt much the same at times like this under his gruff, bluff exterior. He wanted her to be good, needed her to be good. But to show how badly he wanted and needed, that could lead to disaster. "Tell me your lesson again, Susanna." She sighed in mock exasperation, but as she spoke her smile faded and her dark, beautiful face became solemn. And from her lips he heard the old catechism again, made new in her mouth. He had never expected to hear these words from a woman. How natural they sounded, yet how strange and dangerous as well.
I do not aim with my hand. She who aims with her hand has forgotten the face of her father. I aim with my eye. I do not shoot with my hand. She who shoots with her hand has forgotten the face of her father. I shoot with my mind. I do not kill with my gun.
She broke off and pointed at the mica shiny stones on the boulder.
I'm not going to kill anything anyhow. They're just itty-bitty rocks.
Her expression, a little haughty, a little naughty, suggested that she expected Roland to be exasperated with her, perhaps even angry. Roland, however, had been where she was now. He had not forgotten that apprentice gunslingers were fractious and high-spirited, nervy and apt to bite exactly at the wrong moment. And he had discovered an unexpected capacity in himself. He could teach. More, he liked to teach. And he found himself wondering from time to time if that had been true of Court as well. He guessed that it had been. Now more crows began to call, raucously, these from the forest behind them. Some part of Roland's mind registered the fact that the new cries were agitated rather than merely quarrelsome. These birds sounded as if they had been scared up and away from whatever they had been feeding on. He had more important things to think about than whatever it was that had scared a bunch of crows, however, so he simply filed the information away and refocused his concentration on Susanna. To do otherwise with Apprentice was to ask for a second, less playful bite. And who would be to blame for that? Who but the teacher? For was he not training her to bite? Training both of them to bite? Wasn't that what a gunslinger was when you stripped off the few stern lines of ritual and stilled the few iron grace notes of catechism? Wasn't he or she only a human hawk trained to bite on command? No, he said, they're not rocks. She raised her eyebrows a little and began to smile again. Now that she saw he wasn't going to explode at her, as he sometimes did when she was slow or fractious, or at least not yet, her eyes again took on the mocking sun-on-steel glint he associated with Detta Walker. They ain't. The teasing in her voice was still good-natured, but he thought it would turn mean if he let it. She was tense, keyed up, her claws already halfway out of their sheaths. No, they ain't. He said, returning her mockery. His own smile began to return, but it was hard and humorless. Susanna, do you remember the Honk Mafas? Her smile began to fade. The Honk Mafas in Oxford Town? Her smile was gone. Do you remember what the Honk Mafas did to you and your friends?
That wasn't me, she said. That was another woman.
Her eyes had taken on a dull, sullen cast. He hated that look, but he also liked it just fine. It was the right look, the one that said the kindling was burning well and soon the bigger logs would start to catch. Yes, it was. Like it or not, it was Odetta Susanna Holmes, daughter of Sarah Walker Holmes. Not you as you are, but you as you were. Remember the fire hoses, Susanna? Remember the gold teeth? How you saw them when they used the hoses on you and your friends in Oxford? How you saw them twinkle when they laughed? She had told them these things, and many others, over many long nights as the campfire burned low. The gunslinger hadn't understood everything, but he had listened carefully just the same, and remembered. Pain was a tool, after all. Sometimes it was the best tool.
What's wrong with you, Roland? Why do you want to go recalling that trash in my mind?
Now the sullen eyes glinted at him dangerously. They reminded him of Alain's eyes when good-natured Alain was finally roused. Yonder stones are those men, Roland said softly. The men who locked you in a cell and left you to foul yourself. The men with the clubs and the dogs. The men who called you a nigger cunt. He pointed at them, moving his finger from left to right. There's the one who pinched your breast and laughed. There's the one who said he'd better check and see if you had something stuffed up your ass. There's the one who called you a chimpanzee in a $500 dress. That's the one that kept running his billy club over the spokes of your wheelchair until you thought the sound would send you mad.
There's the one who called your friend Leon Pinko Fag, and the one on the end, Susanna, is Jack Mort. There, those stones, those men. She was breathing rapidly now, her bosom rising and falling in swift little jerks beneath the gunslinger's gun belt with its heavy freight of bullets. Her eyes had left him. They were looking at the mica-flecked chips of stone. Behind them, and at some distance, a tree splintered and fell over. More crows called in the sky. Deep in the game, which was no longer a game, neither of them noticed.
"Oh, yeah?" she breathed. "That's so."
"It is. Now say your lesson, Susanna Dean, and be true." This time the words fell from her lips like small chunks of ice. Her right hand trembled lightly on the arm of her wheelchair like an idling engine.
"I do not aim with my hand. She who aims with her hand has forgotten the face of her father. I aim with my eye."
"Good."
"I do not shoot with my hand. She who shoots with her hand has forgotten the face of her father. I shoot with my mind."
"So it has ever been, Susanna Dean."
"I do not kill with my gun. She who kills with her gun has forgotten the face of her father. I kill with my heart."
"Then kill them, for your father's sake," Roland shouted. "Kill them all." Her right hand was a blur between the arm of the chair and the butt of Roland's six-gun. It was out in a second, her left hand descending, fanning at the hammer in flutters almost as swift and delicate as the wing of a hummingbird. Six flat cracks peeled off across the valley, and five of the six chips of stone set atop the boulder blinked out of existence. For a moment neither of them spoke, did not even breathe, it seemed, as the echoes rolled back and forth, dimming. Even the crows were silent, at least for the time being. The gunslinger broke the silence with four toneless yet oddly emphatic words. "It is very well." Susanna looked at the gun in her hand as if she had never seen it before. A tendril of smoke rose from the barrel, perfectly straight in the windless silence. Then, slowly, she returned it to the holster below her bosom.
"Good, but not perfect," she said at last. "I missed one."
"Did you?"
He walked over to the boulder and picked up the remaining chip of stone. He glanced at it, then tossed it to her. She caught it with her left. Her right stayed near the holstered gun, he saw, with approval. She shot better and more naturally than Eddie, but had not learned this particular lesson as swiftly as Eddie had done. If she had been with them during the shootout at Balazar's nightclub, she might have. Now Roland saw she was at last learning that, too. She looked at the stone and saw the notch, barely a sixteenth of an inch deep, in its upper corner. "You only clipped it," Roland said, returning to her, "but in a shooting scrape sometimes that's all you need. If you clip a fellow, throw his aim off..." He paused. "Why are you looking at me that way?"
"You don't know, do you? You really don't?"
"No. Your mind is often closed to me, Susanna."
There was no defensiveness in his voice, and Susanna shook her head in exasperation. The rapid turn and turnabout dance of her personality sometimes unnerved him. His seeming inability to say anything other than exactly what was on his mind never failed to do the same to her. He was the most literal man she had ever met.
"All right," she said. "I'll tell you why I'm looking at you that way, Roland. Because what you did was a mean trick. You said you wouldn't slap me, couldn't slap me, even if I cut up rough. But either you lied or you're very stupid, and I know you ain't stupid. People don't always slap with their hands, as every man and woman of my race could testify. We have a little rhyme where I come from. Sticks and stones will break my bones,
yet taunts shall never wound me," Roland finished.
"Well, that's not exactly the way we say it, but I guess it's close enough. It's bullshit, no matter how you say it. They don't call what you did a tongue-lashing for nothing. Your words hurt me, Roland. Are you going to stand there and say you didn't know they would?"
She sat in her chair, looking up at him with bright, stern curiosity, and Roland thought, not for the first time, that the honk-maffas of Susanna's land Must have been either very brave or very stupid to cross her, wheelchair or no wheelchair. And having walked among them, he didn't think bravery was the answer. "I did not think or care about your hurt," he said patiently. "I saw you show your teeth and knew you meant to bite, so I put a stick in your jaws. And it worked, didn't it?" Her expression was now one of hurt astonishment.
"You bastard!"
Instead of replying, he took the gun from her holster, fumbled the cylinder open with the remaining two fingers on his right hand, and began to reload the chambers with his left hand.
"Of all the high-handed, arrogant—"
"You needed to bite," he said, in that same patient tone. "Had you not, you would have shot all wrong, with your hand and your gun, instead of your eye and mind and heart. Was that a trick? Was it arrogant? I think not. I think, Susanna, that you were the one with arrogance in her heart. I think you were the one with a mind to get up to tricks. That doesn't distress me. Quite the opposite. A gunslinger without teeth is no gunslinger."
"Damn it, I'm not a gunslinger."
He ignored that. He could afford to. If she was no gunslinger, then he was a billy bumbler. "If we were playing a game, I might have behaved differently. But this is no game. It—" His good hand went to his forehead for a moment and paused there, fingers tented just above the left temple. The tips of the fingers, she saw, were trembling minutely.
"Roland, what's ailing you?" she asked quietly.
The hand lowered slowly. He rolled the cylinder back into place and replaced the revolver in the holster she wore. "Nothing."
"Yes, there is. I've seen it. Eddie has, too. It started almost as soon as we left the beach. It's something wrong, and it's getting worse."
"There is nothing wrong," he repeated. She put her hands out and took his. Her anger was gone, at least for the time being. She looked earnestly up into his eyes.
"Eddie and I, this isn't our world, Roland. Without you, we'd die here. We'd have your guns, and we can shoot them. You've taught us to do that well enough. But we'd die just the same. We depend on you. So tell me what's wrong. Let me try to help. Let us try to help."
He had never been a man who understood himself deeply or cared to. The concept of self-consciousness, let alone self-analysis, was alien to him. His way was to act, to quickly consult his own interior, utterly mysterious workings, and then act. Of them all, he had been the most perfectly made, a man whose deeply romantic core was encased in a brutally simple box which consisted of instinct and pragmatism. He took one of those quick looks inside now and decided to tell her everything. There was something wrong with him. Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Something wrong with his mind. Something as simple as his nature and as strange as the weird, wandering life into which that nature had impelled him. He opened his mouth to say, "I'll tell you what's wrong, Susanna, and I'll do it in just three words. I'm going insane." But before he could begin, another tree fell in the forest. It went with a huge, grinding crash. This tree fall was closer, and this time they were not deeply engaged in a test of wills masquerading as a lesson. Both heard it, both heard the agitated cawing of the crows which followed it, and both registered the fact that the tree had fallen close to their camp. Susanna had looked in the direction of the sound, but now her eyes, wide and dismayed, returned to the gunslinger's face.
"Eddie," she said.
A cry rose from the deep green fastness of the woods in back of them, a vast cry of rage. Another tree went, and then another. They fell in what sounded like a hail of mortar fire. Dry wood, the gunslinger thought. Dead trees.
"Eddie!"
This time she screamed it.
"Whatever it is, it's near Eddie!"
Her hands flew to the wheels of her chair and began the laborious job of turning it around. No time for that. Roland seized her under her arms and pulled her free. He had carried her before, when the going was too rough for her wheelchair, both men had, but she was still amazed by his uncanny, ruthless speed. At one moment she was in her wheelchair, an item which had been purchased in New York City's finest medical supply house in the fall of 1962. At the next she was balanced precariously on Roland's shoulders like a cheerleader, her muscular thighs gripping the sides of his neck, his palms over his head and pressing into the small of her back. He began to run with her, his sprung boots slapping the needle-strewn earth between the ruts left by her wheelchair. "Odetta!" he cried, reverting in this moment of stress to the name by which he had first known her. "Don't lose the gun, for your father's sake!" He was sprinting between the trees now. Shadow lace and bright chains of sun-dapple ran across them in moving mosaics as Roland lengthened his stride. They were going downhill now. Susanna raised her left hand to ward off a branch that wanted to slap her from the gunslinger's shoulders. At the same moment she dropped her right hand to the butt of his ancient revolver, cradling it. A mile, she thought. How long to run a mile? How long with him going flat out like this? Not long, if he can keep his feet on these slippery needles, but maybe too long. Let him be all right, Lord. Let my Eddie be all right. As if in answer, she heard the unseen beast loose its cry again. That vast voice was like thunder, like doom. Two. He was the largest creature in the forest which had once been known as the Great West Woods, and he was the oldest. Many of the huge old elms which Roland had noticed in the valley below had been little more than twigs sprouting from the ground. When the bear came out of the dim, unknown reaches of Outworld like a brutal, wandering king. Once the old people had lived in the West Woods, it was their leavings which Roland had found from time to time during the last weeks, and they had gone in fear of the colossal, undying bear. They had tried to kill him when they first discovered they were not alone in the new territory to which they had come, but although their arrows enraged him, they did no serious damage. And he was not confused about the source of his torment, as were the other beasts of the forest, even the predatory bush cats which denned and littered in the sand hills to the west. No, he knew where the arrows came from, this bear. Knew. And for every arrow which found its mark in the flesh below his shaggy pelt, he took 3, 4, perhaps as many as half a dozen of the old people, children if he could get them, women if he could not. Their warriors he disdained, and this was the final humiliation. Eventually, as his real nature became clear to them, their efforts to kill him ceased. He was, of course, a demon incarnate, or the shadow of a god. They called him Mir, which to these people meant the world beneath the world. He stood 70 feet high, and after 18 or more centuries of undisputed rule in the West Woods, he was dying. Perhaps the instrument of his death had at first been a microscopic organism in something he had eaten or drunk. Perhaps it was old age, more likely a combination of both. The cause didn't matter. The ultimate result, a rapidly multiplying colony of parasites foraging within his fabulous brain, did. After years of calculating, brutal sanity, Mir had run mad. The bear had known men were in his woods again. He ruled the forest, and although it was vast, nothing of importance which happened there escaped his attention for long. He had drawn away from the newcomers, not because he was afraid, but because he had no business with them, nor they with him. Then the parasites had begun their work, and as his madness increased, he became sure that it was the old people again, that the trap-setters and forest-burners had returned and would soon set about their old stupid mischief once more. Only as he lay in his final den some 30 miles from the place of the newcomers, sicker with each day's dawning than he had been at sunset the night before, had he come to believe that the old people had finally found some mischief which worked. Poison. He came this time not to take revenge for some petty wound, but to stamp them out entirely before their poison could finish having its way with him, and as he traveled, all thought ceased. What was left was red rage, the rusty buzz of the thing on top of his head, the turning thing between his ears, which had once done its work in smooth silence, and an eerily enhanced sense of smell, which led him unerringly toward the camp of the three pilgrims. The bear, whose real name was not Mir, but something else entirely, made his way through the forest like a moving building, a shaggy tower with reddish-brown eyes. Those eyes glowed with fever and madness. His huge head, now wearing a garland of broken branches and fir needles, swung ceaselessly from side to side. Every now and then he would sneeze in a muffled explosion of sound. Hachoo! And clouds of squirming white parasites would be discharged from his dripping nostrils. His paws, armed with curved talons 3 feet in length, tore at the trees. He walked upright, sinking deep tracks in the soft black soil under the trees. He reeked of fresh balsam and old sour shit. The thing on top of his head whirred and squealed, squealed and whirred. The course of the bear remained almost constant, a straight line which would lead him to the camp of those who had dared return to his forest, who had dared fill his head with dark green agony. Old people or new people, they would die. When he came to a dead tree, he sometimes left the straight path long enough to push it down. The dry, explosive roar of its fall pleased him. When the tree had finally collapsed its rotten length on the forest floor, or come to rest against one of its mates, the bear would push on, through slanting bars of sunlight turned misty with floating motes of sawdust. 3. 2 days before, Eddie Dean had begun carving again. The first time he tried to carve anything since the age of 12. He remembered that he had enjoyed doing it, and he believed he must have been good at it as well. He couldn't remember that part, not for sure, but there was at least one clear indication that it was so. Henry, his older brother, had hated to see him doing it. "Oh, look at the sissy," Henry would say. "What you making today, sissy? A dollhouse? A piss pot for your itty-bitty teeny-peeny? Oh, ain't that cute?" Henry would never come right out and tell Eddie not to do something, would never just walk up to him and say, "Would you mind quitting that, bro? See, it's pretty good, and when you do something that's pretty good, it makes me nervous, because, you see, I'm the one that's supposed to be pretty good at stuff around here. Me, Henry Dean. So what I think I'll do, brother of mine, is just sort of rag on you about certain things. I won't come right out and say, 'Don't do that, it's making me nervous,' because that might make me sound, you know, a little fucked up in the head. But I can rag on you because that's part of what big brothers do, right? All part of the image. I'll rag on you and tease you and make fun of you until you just fucking quit it, okay?" Well, it wasn't okay. Not really, but in the Dean household, things usually went the way Henry wanted them to go. And until very recently, that had seemed right. Not okay, but right. There was a small but crucial difference there, if you could but dig it. There were 2 reasons why it seemed right. One was an on-top reason, the other was an underneath reason. The on-top reason was because Henry had to watch out for Eddie when Mrs. Dean was at work. He had to watch out all the time because once there had been a Dean sister, if you could but dig it. She would have been 4 years older than Eddie and 4 years younger than Henry if she had lived. But that was the thing, you see, because she hadn't lived. She'd been run over by a drunk driver when Eddie was 2. She'd been watching a game of hopscotch on the sidewalk when it happened. As a kid, Eddie had sometimes thought of his sister while listening to Mel Allen doing the play-by-play on the Yankee Baseball Network. Someone would really pound one, and Mel would bellow, "Holy cow, he got all of that one. See ya later." Well, the drunk had gotten all of Gloria Dean. Holy cow, see ya later. Gloria was now in that great upper deck in the sky, and it had not happened because she was unlucky, or because the state of New York had decided not to jerk the jerk's license after his 3rd OUI, or even because God had bent down to pick up a peanut. It had happened, as Mrs. Dean frequently told her sons, because there had been no one around to watch out for Gloria. Henry's job was to make sure nothing like that ever happened to Eddie. That was his job, and he did it, but it wasn't easy. Henry and Mrs. Dean agreed on that, if nothing else. Both of them frequently reminded Eddie of just how much Henry had sacrificed to keep Eddie safe from drunk drivers and muggers and junkies, and possibly even malevolent aliens who might be cruising around in the general vicinity of the upper deck, aliens who might decide to come down from their UFOs on nuclear-powered jet skis at any time in order to kidnap little kids like Eddie Dean. So it was wrong to make Henry more nervous than this terrible responsibility had already made him. If Eddie was doing something that did make Henry more nervous, Eddie ought to cease doing that thing immediately. It was a way of paying Henry back for all the time Henry had spent watching out for Eddie. When you thought about it that way, you saw that doing things better than Henry could do them was very unfair. Then there was the underneath reason. That reason, the world beneath the world, one might say, was more powerful because it could never be stated. Eddie could not allow himself to be better than Henry at much of anything, because Henry was, for the most part, good for nothing. Except watching out for Eddie, of course. Henry taught Eddie how to play basketball in the playground near the apartment building where they lived. This was in a cement suburb where the towers of Manhattan stood against the horizon like a dream, and the welfare check was king. Eddie was 8 years younger than Henry and much smaller, but he was also much faster. He had a natural feel for the game. Once he got on the cracked, hilly cement of the court with the ball in his hands, the moves seemed to sizzle in his nerve endings. He was faster, but that was no big deal. The big deal was this. He was better than Henry. If he hadn't known it from the results of the pickup games in which they sometimes played, he would have known it from Henry's thunderous looks and the hard punches to the upper arm Henry often dealt out on their way home afterwards. These punches were supposedly Henry's little jokes. "Two for flinching," Henry would cry cheerily, and then whap, whap into Eddie's bicep with one knuckle extended. But they didn't feel like jokes. They felt like warnings. They felt like Henry's way of saying, "You better not fake me out and make me look stupid when you drive for the basket, bro. You better remember that I'm watching out for you." The same was true with reading, baseball, ring allevio, math, even jump rope, which was a girl's game. That he was better at these things, or could be better, was a secret that had to be kept at all costs. Because Eddie was the younger brother, because Henry was watching out for him. But the most important part of the underneath reason was also the simplest. These things had to be kept secret because Henry was Eddie's big brother, and Eddie adored him. 4. 2 days ago, while Susanna was skinning out a rabbit and Roland was starting supper, Eddie had been in the forest just south of camp. He had seen a funny spur of wood jutting out of a fresh stump. A weird feeling, he supposed it was the one people called déjà vu, swept over him, and he found himself staring fixedly at the spur, which looked like a badly shaped doorknob. He was distantly aware that his mouth had gone dry. After several seconds, he realized he was looking at the spur sticking out of the stump, but thinking about the courtyard behind the building where he and Henry had lived, thinking about the feel of the warm cement under his ass and the whopping smells of garbage from the dumpster around the corner in the alley. In this memory, he had a chunk of wood in his left hand and a paring knife from the drawer by the sink in his right. The chunk of wood jutting from the stump had called up the memory of that brief period when he had fallen violently in love with wood carving. It was just that the memory was buried so deep he hadn't realized at first what it was. What he had loved most about carving was the seeing part, which happened even before you began. Sometimes you saw a car or a truck, sometimes a dog or cat. Once, he remembered, it had been the face of an idol. One of the spooky Easter Island monoliths he had seen in an issue of National Geographic at school. That had turned out to be a good one. The game was to find out how much of that thing you could get out of the wood without breaking it. You could never get it all, but if you were very careful, you could sometimes get quite a lot. There was something inside the boss on the side of the stump. He thought he might be able to release quite a lot of it with Roland's knife. It was the sharpest, handiest tool he had ever used. Something inside the wood, waiting patiently for someone like him, to come along and let it out, to set it free. "Aw, look at the sissy. What you making today, sissy? A dollhouse? A piss pot for your itty-bitty teeny peeny? A slingshot so you can pretend to hunt rabbits just like the big boys? Aw, ain't that cute?" He felt a burst of shame,
A sense of wrongness. That strong sense of secrets that must be kept at any cost. And then he remembered, again, that Henry Dean, who had in his later years become the great sage and eminent junkie, was dead. This realization had still not lost its power to surprise. It kept hitting him in different ways, sometimes with sorrow, sometimes with guilt, sometimes with anger. On this day, 2 days before the great bear came charging out of the green corridors of the woods, it had hit him in the most surprising way of all. He had felt relief and a soaring joy. He was free. Eddie had borrowed Roland's knife. He used it to cut carefully around the jutting boss of wood, then brought it back and sat beneath a tree with it, turning it this way and that. He was not looking at it. He was looking into it. Susanna had finished with a rabbit. The meat went into the pot, over the fire. The skin she stretched between two sticks, tying it with hanks of rawhide from Roland's purse. Later on, after the evening meal, Eddie would begin scraping it clean. She used her hands and arms, slipping effortlessly over to where Eddie was sitting, with his back propped against the tall old pine. At the campfire, Roland was crumbling some arcane and no doubt delicious woods herb into the pot. "What's doing, Eddie?" Eddie had found himself restraining an absurd urge to hide the boss of wood behind his back.
"Nothing," he said. "Thought I might, you know, carve something."
He paused, then added,
"I'm not very good, though."
He sounded as if he might be trying to reassure her of this fact. She had looked at him, puzzled. For a moment she seemed on the verge of saying something, then simply shrugged and left him alone. She had no idea why Eddie seemed ashamed to be passing a little time in whittling. Her father had done it all the time. But if it was something that needed to be talked about, she supposed Eddie would get to it in his own time. He knew the guilty feelings were stupid and pointless, but he also knew he felt more comfortable doing this work when Roland and Susanna were out of camp. Old habits, it seemed, sometimes died hard. Beating heroin was child's play compared to beating your childhood. When they were away, hunting or shooting or keeping Roland's peculiar form of school, Eddie found himself able to turn to his piece of wood with surprising skill and increasing pleasure. The shape was in there, all right. He had been right about that. It was a simple one, and Roland's knife was setting it free with an eerie ease. Eddie thought he was going to get almost all of it, and that meant the slingshot might actually turn out to be a practical weapon. Not much compared to Roland's big revolvers, maybe, but something he had made himself, just the same, his. And this idea pleased him very much. When the first crows rose in the air, cawing affrightedly, he did not hear. He was already thinking, hoping, that he might see a tree with a bow trapped in it before too long. Five. He heard the bear approaching before Roland and Susanna did, but not much before. He was lost in that high daze of concentration which accompanies the creative impulse at its sweetest and most powerful. He had suppressed these impulses for most of his life, and now this one held him wholly in its grip. Eddie was a willing prisoner. He was pulled from his daze not by the sound of falling trees, but by the rapid thunder of a .45 from the south. He looked up, smiling, and brushed hair from his forehead with a sawdusty hand. In that moment, sitting with his back against a tall pine in the clearing which had become home, his face crisscrossed with opposing beams of green-gold forest light, he looked handsome indeed. A young man with unruly dark hair which constantly tried to spill across his high forehead. A young man with a strong, mobile mouth and hazel eyes. For a moment his eyes shifted to Roland's other gun, hanging by its belt from a nearby branch. And he found himself wondering how long it had been since Roland had gone anywhere without at least one of his fabulous weapons hanging by his side. That question led to two others. How old was he? This man who had plucked Eddie and Susanna from their world and their wens. And more important, what was wrong with him? Susanna had promised to broach that subject, if she shot well and didn't get Roland's back hair up, that was. Eddie didn't think Roland would tell her. Not at first. But it was time to let old Long Tall and Ugly know that they knew something was wrong.
"There'll be water if God wills it," Eddie said. He turned back to his carving with a little smile playing on his lips. They had both begun to pick up Roland's little sayings, and he theirs. It was almost as if they were halves of the same. Then a tree fell close by in the forest, and Eddie was on his feet in a second, the half-carved slingshot in one hand, Roland's knife in the other. He stared across the clearing in the direction of the sound, heart thumping, all his senses finally alert. Something was coming. Now he could hear it, trampling its heedless way through the underbrush, and he marveled bitterly that this realization had come so late. Far back in his mind, a small voice told him this was what he got. This was what he got for doing something better than Henry, for making Henry nervous. Another tree fell with a ratcheting, coughing crash. Looking down a ragged aisle between the tall firs, Eddie saw a cloud of sawdust rise in the still air. The creature responsible for that cloud suddenly bellowed, a raging, gut-freezing sound. It was one huge motherfucker, whatever it was. He dropped the chunk of wood, then flipped Roland's knife at a tree 15 feet to his left. It somersaulted twice in the air, and then stuck halfway to the hilt in the wood, quivering. He grabbed Roland's .45 from the place where it hung and cocked it. Stand or run? But he discovered he no longer had the luxury of that question. The thing was fast as well as huge, and it was now too late to run. A gigantic shape began to disclose itself in that aisle of trees north of the clearing, a shape which towered above all but the tallest trees. It was lumbering directly toward him, and as its eyes fixed upon Eddie Dean, it gave voice to another of those cries.
"Oh, man, I'm fucked," Eddie whispered as another tree bent, cracked like a mortar, then crashed to the forest floor in a cloud of dust and dead needles. Now it was lumbering straight toward the clearing where he stood, a bear the size of King Kong. Its footfalls made the ground shake.
"What will you do, Eddie?" Roland suddenly asked. "Think. It's the only advantage you have over yon beast. What will you do?"
He didn't think he could kill it. Maybe with a bazooka, but probably not with the gunslinger's .45. He could run, but had an idea that the oncoming beast might be pretty fast when it wanted to be. He guessed the chances of ending up as jammed between the great bear's toes might be as high as 50-50. So which one was it going to be? Stand here and start shooting, or run like his hair was on fire and his ass was catching? It occurred to him that there was a third choice. He could climb. He turned toward the tree against which he had been leaning. It was a huge, hoary pine, easily the tallest tree in this part of the woods. The first branch spread out over the forest floor in a feathery green fan about 8 feet up. Eddie dropped the revolver's hammer and then jammed the gun into the waistband of his pants. He leaped for the branch, grabbed it, and did a frantic chin-up. Behind him, the bear gave voice to another bellow as it burst into the clearing. The bear would have had him just the same, would have left Eddie Dean's guts hanging in gaudy strings from the lowest branches of the pine, if another of those sneezing fits had not come on it at that moment. It kicked the ashy remains of the campfire into a black cloud, and then stood almost doubled over, huge front paws on its huge thighs, looking for a moment like an old man in a fur coat, an old man with a cold. It sneezed again and again, achoo, 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 and clouds of parasites blew out of its muzzle. Hot urine flowed in a stream between its legs and hissed out the campfire scattered embers. Eddie did not waste the few crucial extra moments he had been given. He went up the tree like a monkey on a stick, pausing only once to make sure the gunslinger's revolver was still seated firmly in the waistband of his pants. He was in terror, already half convinced that he was going to die. What else could he expect now that Henry wasn't around to watch out for him? But a crazy laughter raved through his head just the same. "Been treed," he thought. "How about that, sports fans? Been treed by Bearzilla!" The creature raised its head again, the thing turning between its ears, catching winks and flashes of sunlight as it did so, then charged Eddie's tree. It reached high with one paw and slashed forward, meaning to knock Eddie loose like a pine cone. The paw tore through the branch he was standing on just as he lunged upward to the next. That paw tore through one of his shoes as well, pulling it from his foot and sending it flying in two ragged pieces.
"That's okay," Eddie thought. "You can have 'em both, Brer Bear, if you want. Goddamn things were worn out anyway."
The bear roared and lashed at the tree, cutting deep wounds in its ancient bark, wounds which bled clear, resinous sap. Eddie kept on yanking himself up. The branches were thinning now, and when he risked a glance down, he stared directly into the bear's muddy eyes. Below its cocked head, the clearing had become a target, with the scattered smudge of campfire as its bullseye. "Missed me, you hairy motherfu—" Eddie began. And then the bear, its head still cocked back to look at him, sneezed. Eddie was immediately drenched in hot snot that was filled with thousands of small white worms. They wriggled frantically on his shirt, his forearms, his throat and face. Eddie screamed in mingled surprise and revulsion. He began to brush at his eyes and mouth, lost his balance, and just managed to hook an arm around the branch beside him in time. He held on and raked at his skin, wiping off as much of the wormy phlegm as he could. The bear roared and hit the tree again. The pine rocked like a mast in a gale, but the fresh claw marks which appeared were at least 7 feet below the branch on which Eddie's feet were planted. The worms were dying, he realized, must have begun dying as soon as they left the infected swamps inside the monster's body. It made him feel a little better, and he began to climb again. He stopped 12 feet further up, daring to go no higher. The trunk of the pine, easily 8 feet in diameter at its base, was now no more than 18 inches through the middle. He had distributed his weight on 2 branches, but he could feel both of them bending springily beneath him. He had a crow's nest view of the forest and foothills to the west now, spread out below him in an undulating carpet. Under other circumstances, it would have been a view to relish. "Top of the world, Ma," he thought. He looked down into the bear's upturned face again, and for a moment all coherent thought was driven from his mind by simple amazement. There was something growing out of the bear's skull, and to Eddie it looked like a small radar dish. The gadget turned jerkily, kicking up flashes of sun as it did, and Eddie could hear it screaming thinly. He had owned a few old cars in his time, the kind that sat in the used car lots with the words Handyman Special soaked on the windshields, and he thought the sound coming from that gadget was the sound of bearings which will freeze up if they're not replaced soon. The bear uttered a long, purring growl. Yellowish foam, thick with worms, squeezed between its paws in curdled gobbets. If he had never looked into the face of utter lunacy, and he supposed he had, having been eyeball to eyeball with that world-class bitch Detta Walker on more than one occasion, Eddie was looking into it now. But that face was, thankfully, a good 30 feet below him, and at their highest reach those killing talons were 15 feet under the soles of his feet. And unlike the trees upon which the bear had vented its spleen as it approached the clearing, this one was not dead.
"Mexican standoff, honey," Eddie panted.
He wiped sweat from his forehead with one sap-sticky hand and flicked the mess down into the bugbear's face. Then the creature the old people had called Mir embraced the tree with its great forepaws and began to shake it. Eddie grabbed the trunk and held on for dear life, eyes squeezed into grim slits as the pine began to sway back and forth like a pendulum.